since our time will be a bit compressed. I did not choose the title for this session or any of my sessions. I can only speculate as to why the particular words were chosen that have drawn you here today. But I rather imagine that the emphasis on how to be a sensitive shepherd was chosen because of the title of my book on leadership, Systems Sensitive Leadership, subtitled How to Empower Diversity Without Polarizing the Church. We'll have some things to say about that tomorrow. I don't know if you didn't know me and didn't know that book, what you thought we would be talking about under the heading of being a sensitive leader. And I'm not going to talk about the book except indirectly today. I'm really going to talk about leadership in a much broader sweep than the narrow range of considerations that we look at in the book. But the word sensitive is a rather loaded one in our world. It particularly connotes being warm and fuzzy, a feeling set of sensations. When a wife says, "My husband just isn't sensitive enough," you know that she's wanting someone who's a little bit more cuddly and a little bit more touchy-feely, as we say. And on our ministerial staff, we have 7 ministers on staff. About half of them are very touchy-feely folk. I ain't one of them. So if you came here today to learn how to be a touchy-feely leader, you're barking up the wrong tree. I'm not your man. I understand that. I appreciate the power of it. I am tickled pink that I've got people all around me who do it well. That's not my natural bend, and I can do it, but it's not the first thing that comes to mind when I start dealing with people. I'm more the analytical type, more the sit back and trip, figure out what's going on here type, rather than the embrace and let me share your pain type. Well, the Lord needs both types, right? In fact, He needs more types than that. So we complement one another. And today, I'm going to be talking more about being a sensitive leader in 2 other senses of the word sensitive. First of all, to encourage us to learn to deal with people utilizing all of our senses. You see, one of the things that tends to happen, especially with us as men, when we get into a conversation with someone, especially if it's a bit emotional or loaded, we very quickly get more preoccupied with what I'm going to say in response to what they're saying than really listening to what is going on. If you've not read Deborah Tonin's book, You Just Don't Understand, pick that up. As a linguist, she has studied the difference in the strategies that men use and women use in communication. She discovered as a researcher that by the time we're 2 or 3 years old, men and women have developed absolutely different strategies for what they do with talk. Women use talk to build community and collegiality. Their games very early are negotiated games. Would you like to play house? What if we did this? Why don't we try to do it this way? It's a language of building relationships, of building cooperation. Little boys, as soon as they can start talking, start using language to establish power structures. They don't negotiate the rules. One takes charge and says, "You're going to do it this way, and you're going to do it this way, and I'm in charge." And someone will challenge him, and if the challenger succeeds, the challenger now gets to make the rules. And those 2 basic strategies continue to be a fundamental difference in the primary way that most men and most women approach communication for the rest of their lives. And we have to work against that if we're going to be sensitive leaders, listening to people with all of our sensory acuity. Because when you start talking and I start figuring out how I'm going to top this, how I'm going to one-up you, to go inside and do that processing, I have to shut down some of the information flow that's coming to me. Now, let me tell you why that's dangerous. Our bodies are engineered neurologically, physiologically, biologically to filter out information. The eye can process between 130,000 and 160,000 bits of information simultaneously. But the optic nerve coming out of the eye can only carry a fraction of that information. And when the optic nerve gets back to the visual cortex, there is a further reduction in the throughput channel, what those of you in computers call bandwidth. So what happens is that before I ever see the image in here, most of the information coming in has already been deleted out by a biological process that we don't fully understand. And at any given moment, we can only track between 7 and 9, some people as few as 5, but most of us between 7 and 9 simultaneous streams of information. So right now you are being bombarded with billions and billions and billions of bits of information, and you're only monitoring about 6 or 7 streams of it so that you won't be overwhelmed by all the rest of it. So as you're sitting here listening to this, you aren't even aware of how cool your left ear is. But you are now. Because as soon as I said that, your unconscious mind shut down one of the channels, whatever it was monitoring, the one that was least critical at the moment, and devoted those resources to checking out the temperature of your left ear. And I don't know what it was that it quit monitoring at that point, probably the weight of your left foot on the floor. Oh, you noticed that now, did you? See? That's the way we work. We are built so that we naturally are filtering out information to begin with. Now, if that's the way we are already biased and built, imagine what happens when I'm in an important conversation with you and I shut down even more of the input to go inside and figure out what I'm going to say next. That means we are not being sensory sensitive to the person we're listening to. The other way in which I want to talk about sensitive leadership is having the ability to sense what is going on out of sight. What's going on beneath what's going on beneath what's going on? I spent 35 years in active duty and reserve components of the Navy. I love the sea. I love ships. But in those 35 years, I started off on the deck force, ended up as a captain, and I saw a lot of evolutions in the Navy over those years. Not the least of which, we went from being a Navy that fired big guns to a Navy that fired big missiles. And when you're firing missiles off the deck of your ship, you don't have a lot of other things that you want up there cluttering it. And so over the years, ships became more and more streamlined and uncluttered on the main deck. Now when you see that combatant pull into port, it is sleek, it is streamlined, and everything seems to be meticulously placed and immaculately maintained on the main deck. That's what you see. But down beneath that deck, in the decks 2, 3, and 4 down, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on you never see. There are elevators moving weapons up and down. There are shafts whirring. There are steam turbines screeching. There are cables and conduits going everywhere. There are people yelling and shouting and communication going here and there. There's a whole lot of stuff going on under there. That is why things are going so smoothly on the surface. Well, that's the way we're built too. 90% of what's going on is going on outside of conscious awareness. It is going on in what we call the unconscious mind. And we're making more of our decisions at an unconscious level than we often realize. And when I'm talking with you, it's important for me to know that what you're saying is the top deck. That down beneath that, there's a lot more going on that I need to be sensitive to. Now, let me give you an example of this just from the last few weeks. I had a man join me in a pain support group that I'm running right now, a group of people who have chronic pain, and we're meeting together trying to find some internal resources, psychological resources they can use to manage their pain better. He joined us very late, and I was concerned because he was coming into this well after we had done a lot of training. But he was one of these people who makes up very quickly for lost time. And he came in one night as I was talking about how negative emotions are stacked within us. And the typical stack is that anger is running on top of a fear. And fear is running on top of a deep sadness. And sadness is running on top of a hurt. And the hurt is masking from view a limiting decision we have made about ourselves, about the world, or about the options we have for dealing with this stack. And I had developed this with the group several times. I was just briefing them on it. He took furious notes. He came back the next week and he said, "Well, would you like a report?" I said, "Sure, what about?" He said, "I had a fellow Christian. We were elders together in the church who really did me bad in a business deal 17 years ago. He was my best friend, and he really did a bad one on me. And I thought I got over that a long time ago, but I knew I couldn't forgive him. I have prayed every day for 17 years to be able to forgive the man, and I could not forgive. I could not figure out why I couldn't forgive till your little exercise last week." And he said, "I went home, and I got to thinking about, is there any anger on that?" And there was. That I hadn't processed, and I got rid of the anger. Then I said, "Was there a fear under that anger?" And I worked on that for a while, and I discovered, yeah, there were some fears under there, and I got rid of that. "Well, was there some, was there some sadness under there I hadn't processed?" "Yeah, I found that." And he said, "You know, when I got rid of the sadness and the hurt, I found the limiting decision. I discovered that 17 years ago, deep within me, I said, if I ever forgive him, he'll get away with it." So the unconscious mind all this time was running on a program, "I can't forgive, or that will mean he gets away with it." Consciously, he was not aware of the decision. He just knew that his prayers for 17 years seemed to go unanswered. That's what I mean when I say a lot's going on beneath what's going on. And we need to become sensitive to watching for that. Well, what are some things we can watch for to be more sensitive to what's going on? We're going to introduce some things today that we'll come back to in additional lessons. But I want to speak about two or three arenas in just sort of a broad introduction here this afternoon. First of all, I want to acquaint you with a set of reactions that you go through and that I go through completely outside of conscious awareness in the first millisecond after we start processing information. The big name for these programs is metaprograms. They're the way we go at life. For instance, if I were to ask you, if I were to reach into my pocket here and pull out a handful of change, and I were to say, "I'd like you to describe these three coins to me." Okay? "I would like you to describe these three coins to me." Somebody would look at them and say, "Well, they're all American currency. They all have a national leader's figure on one side and some other kind of national symbol on the other side." They would describe them that way. Someone else would say, "Well, you know, this one's a quarter and this one's a dime and this one's a penny. You know, this one's brown, the other two are silver. And you know, these two have sort of serrated edges and this one's got a smooth edge. What did this person just do?" He described them in terms of how they are different, whereas the first person described them in terms of how they are alike. We all make a decision fairly early in life based on experiences and a number of other things that are going on, perhaps unconsciously, whether when we encounter something new, we will look at it in terms of how it's the same as what we've already done or how it's different from what we've already done. We sort by sameness or difference. Now, most of us, if we are prone toward sameness, will first see the sameness. And then we'll also notice, oh yeah, and there are some differences. But what I see is the same, basically, but there are some differences. If I sort by difference, the first thing I'm going to see is how different this is from anything else. And I'm going to see the difference so big, it's going to take me a while to see the sameness. Understand that's what's going on Sunday morning when you make a minor change in the worship service. And someone comes up and says, "Well, do we even believe in baptism anymore around here?" You just bumped into someone who sorts first by difference. They are super sensitized to how different even the smallest change is. Do we need folk like that in our world? You betcha. You don't want a quality control engineer who sorts by sameness. You don't want an auditor who sorts by sameness. You don't want a police detective who sorts by sameness. We have a place in our society for people who can immediately look at a group of things and see the one that's different. The problem is, if you're a sameness person, and you approved as a leader this little change because it's just a minor departure from what we've already been doing anyway, in fact, it's basically just the same, you're going to be completely taken aback by this person who suddenly is ready to go to war because we don't stand for anything around here anymore. So that's one of the sorts we learn to watch for. And we must anticipate that in a congregation of any size, about 40% of the people will sort by difference first. My experience is that most leaders tend to have gotten to where they are in leadership because they have a bias towards sorting by sameness. They are able to accommodate change and to move out and do different things and do new things and succeed as leaders because they've got a bias towards seeing things as being fundamentally a continuity with the past. And sometimes when they make a decision to change something, they see it as minor and don't understand that people who sit there who sort by difference are going to see it as a major, major shift in what we've done. Now, there's another one that's running down inside of here. And that is that we are all motivated by one of two things. We are either motivated to move away from things we don't want, or we are motivated to move toward the things we desire. We refer to these as an away from and a toward motivation. Underneath the away from, there is a fear. Underneath the toward, there is a dream. Some people are motivated by fear. Some people are motivated by dreams. Now, all of us have some away froms. I don't plan to put my hand on a hot stove anytime soon. When I'm working in the kitchen and I reach over toward the stove and a burner has been left on and I sense that heat, I have an immediate away from. But many people sort so heavily by away froms that underneath what you see going on is a lot of fear. And we have to be sensitive to that fear that's running underneath there. Just an example. I knew an elder one time, very compassionate, caring, pastoral man, who nonetheless, though he saw himself as open and progressive, fought every little change that the other elders tried to make when it came to decentralizing the control of that congregation. To empower a committee, to empower a group of deacons, to empower anyone on the ministerial staff, just immediately led his heels to dig in. And one day I was talking to him about this, and he said, "You don't understand." He said, "On the day of judgment, if this church has gotten out of control, it's not the preachers God's going to hold accountable. It's not the members God's going to hold accountable. It's me that's going to have to answer if this thing gets out of control." And hear that fear running under there? Here was a man who, by his maturity, ought to be running a very strong grace outlook. And he talked grace. And he taught grace. And he prayed grace. But you know what ran him? Fear. And he didn't even really realize it. He thought he was a grace-oriented man. But what I was just dealing with was an away from. Boy, I don't want to stand before God and have to explain how this thing got out of control. Well, I just sort of put him in a double bind immediately. I figured the best way to neutralize this man for the moment was to put him in a double bind. And so I did. I took that away from he had over here, and I put another away from over here on the other side of him to absolutely paralyze him. And this is the way I did it. I said, "Well, you know, I can understand that. You know, standing before God on the day of judgment is pretty serious business. And I just wonder, since you're ready to answer for that, how are you going to answer for something else? He said, what's that? And I said, how are you going to answer when he says, you know, I kept bringing into your congregation all these bright, motivated, capable young deacons that I had great plans for in the kingdom, but because you never were willing to empower them or entrust them, they became so frustrated they left the kingdom and I never got to make use of them. How are you going to answer that one? I mean, he literally turned ashen. He began to tremble all over. I didn't realize how heavily I'd loaded this thing in. And he stood up and he sort of shook for a moment and he said, I had never thought about that. And he went stumbling out. Okay? Now here is a man that on the surface you would think is grace oriented, but there's fear running underneath. Now, I used his fear against him to free up something that needed to be freed up in that leadership. I would not do that most of the time. This was a unique strategic moment. But when I'm dealing with someone and there's a fear running underneath there, I want to respect that fear. I want to get in there and deal with them at the level of that fear. Another difference that runs underneath, and again, we're going to come back to all of these things in subsequent lessons. So if you've got questions or you're not sure where this goes, bear with us. Another is that many people do not feel safe or secure without rules. Other people don't feel safe and secure without options. Okay? You put a lot of options in front of the rule-oriented person, and their first question is going to be, well, which one should I do? Hear the question about a rule? You put a lot of rules on the options person, and they say, don't you trust me enough to make a good choice? We are divided between being options people and rules people. That's going to shape our theology as an individual. Rules people read the story of Jesus and the stories of Jesus and draw a whole different set of conclusions from them than options people do. Options people see Jesus as blessing people and empowering people and cutting people free to go do. The rules people see Jesus spelling out a lot of things you better measure up to before the day of judgment. Okay? Now, those two different mindsets are going to be things that impact the way people respond to what you put forward. If as a leadership we put forward lots of choices, a lot of our people are going to like that. Some of our people are going to react to it with insecurity. They need rules to feel secure. But there's another element that with a lot of rules feels stultified, feels choked, feels compressed. And part of our challenge is working between those two. Still another one. It's sort of close to the sameness and difference. It's what we call people who match or mismatch. Mismatchers are the people who can always tell you the one place your plan won't work. You ever had that? I mean, you lay out this extensive plan and everybody is oohing and aahing and this person says, yeah, but this won't work. And they are magnificent mismatchers. What do they do to the motivation of the group? What do they do to the unity of the group? What do they do to the esprit of the group? Mismatchers are really one of the primary challenges you and I have as leaders when it comes to motivation. Getting them on board and getting them to talk supportively of what it is we're about. And mismatchers often come in another profile. It's what we call small chunk processing. You see, some people process ideas in big chunks, and some people process ideas in little chunks. It's the comparison between someone who understands a grapevine by taking the whole cluster and studying the whole thing, and then he begins to notice the grapes, and then he begins to notice the stems. As opposed to a person who first studies this grape, and then studies this grape, and then studies how they're all connected together, and then begins to see the cluster, and finally notices it's hanging off a vine. Some people take the little details and put them together to get the big picture. That's about half of our people. About another half of our people start with the big picture and they work down to the little details. Where do most leaders tend to fall? They probably got to leadership because they're capable of some pretty big picture thinking. And so they go out and they present their plan so that they think it's spelled out magnificently because they painted the entire big picture. And they can't believe some very bright, capable people who say, "Man, I don't understand what's going on here. But we explained it thoroughly." Well, maybe to somebody, but I don't understand what's going on. A great many of our people need all the little details before they can see how it fits together. They put it together backwards to the way you and I put it together. Now, the worst person to work with on your leadership team, it's bad enough when they're in your congregation. It is really rough when they're on your leadership team, is the person who processes by small chunks and mismatches. Because they will get you tied up for 30 minutes on the most minute detail that until they're satisfied in their own mind on that small detail, they can't go on and see anything else. I know a minister a few years ago who was proposing a major sweeping redesign of the ministry structure of this congregation he was in. And he wanted to be sure that he understood any of the concerns that each one of the elders had. So he came to me and he mapped out how he wanted to present this graphically. And I did some critiquing with him and coached him on some things. And he went back to his office and got a big white board and he mapped out this whole thing with all of its ramifications in a way that he could sort of explain it with a good visual aid there. And then he set appointments up with every elder to come in and give him an hour of their time to work through this with them one-on-one to be sure that they understood what he was proposing and that he had heard any reservations they had. There were 8 elders in that congregation, if I remember correctly. 7 of them were in and out in 40 to 45 minutes. There was another one who was a small chunk mismatcher. I know him very well. He's done this to me so many times, I can almost script what must have happened in that room. Who was there 2.5 hours, and they never got beyond the first point. Because halfway through the first point, he looked over on the board and saw something that didn't seem to fit, and he went to that and started mismatching on it. And he was so zeroed in on it, my friend would say, "Well, we're going to deal with that. If you see the broader context, when we get there, you'll see how that fits." "Well, explain it to me." "Well, we're going to in a minute. But what are you going to explain to me?" And he spent 2.5 hours trying to explain that without the man having the frame of reference that would have made sense of it. Now you see, this man is a good man. He's a generous man. He is a great Bible teacher. He is a respected man in the community. He is a man of integrity. He is just a problem to work with in leadership sometimes. And I've told him that. You know, if he hears this tape, he'll say, "Yep, he's talking about me. He's told me that." Unfortunately, there are 7 or 8 people out there who hear this tape and say, "Yep, he's talking about me. He's told me that." Because one of my missions is to help small chunk mismatchers understand what they're doing to the morale and the motivation of the group. Now then, I tell you how I deal with him. When I am going to make a presentation to him, is this sneaky or is this sneaky? I always throw in something that's obviously not right, real early in the presentation, that I can change and not affect anything else. And I start laying this out if I'm trying to get him behind a fundraising effort, or if I'm trying to get him to be on the board of some organization, or I'm trying to get him to help with some work someplace. I'll start laying this out to him, and about 3 minutes into it, I know he's going to start his ministry. And he'll say, but wait a minute, now this doesn't fit. And I say, "Now you're probably right. Well, let's make it fit. How do you think that would fit?" "Well, it looks like we ought to do it this way." "Well, that's a good idea. Let's do it that way, okay?" And we're okay from then on. He got his mismatch in. He got to fix it. And he's okay. Now, there are some other mismatches will come up, but we've built the momentum already that we're going to find a way to work around his mismatches, and it's okay. These are the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about the next 2 days when I talk about being sensitive to what's going on underneath what's going on. And I'm going to draw some material out of my book on system-sensitive leadership on the three thinking systems out of eight that are really our problem in the place where most of our conflict is happening in the church today, systems 4, 5, and 6. And I'm going to show how these deeper dynamics that we're talking about here are at play within those systems. System 4 tends to sort by difference. System 6 tends to sort by sameness. System 4 tends to sort small chunk. System 6 tends to sort large chunk. And these systems, which some of you have read about, because I know some of you have read that book and have dialogued with me about it, are made more complex by these other things that are running underneath them. And so we're going to sort of be marrying things out of the book with other things that we didn't have room to put in the book. And if you've not read the book and you'd be interested in it, tomorrow I'll have copies here available for you, or you can buy them College Press Bookstore. They're the publisher. But we're primarily going to be focused on seeing beneath the surface, seeing what's going on below deck, and understanding how we as leaders work with what's going on below deck so that everything above deck runs smoothly. I'll see you tomorrow.